This is The Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. Today's episode is sponsored by Bank on Yourself. My guest today, and I'm incredibly excited about this, is Nick Cave, the music legend I've been listening to since he emerged from Australia in the late 1970s and early 1980s. Over the years, Nick Cave has written screenplays, soundtracks, novels. He's collaborated with everyone from Johnny Cash to Kylie Minogue to PJ Harvey to Neko Case. Since 2018, he's published The Red Hand Files, where he answers readers' questions in a manner that is deeply vulnerable, touching, and insightful. He's got a new album out with his longtime band, The Bad Seeds. It's called Wild God. We talk about this astonishing record, along with his unshakable commitments to free speech, how the death of his 15-year-old son affected his art, his abiding interest in ritual and religion, and why he refuses to join artist boycotts of countries such as Israel. Today's episode is sponsored by The Dispatch, your source for unbiased news and commentary informed by conservative principles. Is Donald Trump really going to jail? Does Joe Biden really have what it takes for a second term? Do these questions even matter in the 2024 U.S. election? Get past the bluster and get back to the facts by joining The Dispatch. The Dispatch provides original reporting and commentary on politics, policy, and culture, and it's all informed by conservative principles. Their newsletters and podcasts offer fact-based analysis to help members make sense of the biggest domestic and international stories of the day. The Dispatch has created a home for the politically homeless and provides a needed and welcome sense of humor as their writers explain the news. Reason listeners can try an exclusive 30-day free trial membership. Just click the link in the show notes to join The Dispatch today. Here is The Reason Interview with Nick Cave. Let's talk first about your forthcoming album, or the new album, Wild God.
Can I ask you something before we...
Yeah.
Do you normally do... I've listened to a lot of Reason.
Okay.
But I've never heard a kind of celebrity-style music thing. Do you normally do that?
What do you mean? Like...
Well, you know, I've heard a lot of... politics and so forth.
Egghead, but, intellectuals.
Well,
sometimes.
You know, that kind of thing, but not so much, you know, music orientated stuff. And that, if I just got that wrong. Or,
yeah. I mean, I've,
I'm concerned for your audience.
No. I'm just thinking in the past couple of years, we've talked to Frank Portman of, the Mr. T Experience, the West Coast post-punk band, Frank Turner.
Okay, so we're not out on a limb here on our own.
Oh, no, not at all. And actually, I mean, this is, you know, in a way, I've listened to you, you know, since I was a lad, and I'm a few years younger than you. But what's emerged over the past, 6 years, 7 years, particularly the Red Hand Files, this is one of the things I'm most interested in talking with you about,
really?
Is both the content of that, what you're writing about, but also the fact of it. You know, you are a rock musician who talks, who channels a lot of kind of religious ecstasy and agony. And yet here you are, instead of being a distant Jesus, you know, instead of being Jim Morrison, way, way off in the Hollywood Bowl away from people, you are intermingling with your audience in a very direct, barely mediated way. And so I find that in general, one of the most interesting things, developments of the past 40 years, the way everything has become more leveled. And so producer and consumer are in more of a conversation. And I think you're making that explicit. Does that make any sense to you?
You mean that everything's become more leveled in our culture?
Yeah. It's harder for, an authority, and that could be a politician, it could be a businessman, it could be a rock star, it could be a priest, to stand apart from their crowd or from their audience. Like, everybody is more in a mix now.
Yeah, well, it's funny. I mean, I don't know if this at all answers your question, but what I wanted to do initially, because I sort of discovered, I think, the idea of the podcast.
Right.
Years ago, mm-hmm. you know, back with early Joe Rogan mm-hmm. and that sort of stuff, that lovely idea that he, I guess he stumbled upon, which mm-hmm. was that people were happy to listen to 3-hour yep. conversations,
right.
you know, that people's attention span actually wasn't small like right. everyone thought. And this was sort of a radical thing. And I kind of had an urge, you know, my son had died
yeah.
and I'd received a lot of letters from people who a similar thing had happened mm-hmm. and they were very helpful to me. And I felt, look, I can speak about this stuff and maybe I could do a podcast. But the more I thought, I even sent my long-suffering assistant off to learn about podcasts, right? She did like a podcast course. But by the time she finished the course, I decided that the podcast just wasn't for me, that I didn't,
yeah.
that it was too revealing
mm-hmm.
and it was too, there was too little control,
right.
I think. I was just worried about how much, I had no control over how much I could give away.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just decided that I would do this sort of small idea, really, which was an ask me anything kind right. of agony aunt
yeah.
type of thing. I just, no, actually the agony aunt thing came a little bit later, but it was right. first it was just an ask me anything in the back of my mind, hoping people would ask me interesting things.
Yeah.
Now, initially people just asked, what's your, you know, favorite Dylan song and,
right.
and kind of music stuff. But I gradually expanded it outwards yeah. to include all sorts of different things. And now, I don't know, 6 years later or something like that, it has become the central sort of pillar
mm.
from which everything I do kind of revolves around.
Yeah, and I've heard you spend like 3 days a week on it.
That's right.
So
that's
and you
yeah,
just I mean, passed in July. You said that you had received your 100,000th question.
Yeah.
So I mean,
so
this,
all of which I've read.
Yeah.
But you know, I feel by doing this, and you mm-hmm. must know this yourself. I feel inextricably connected to people, and not just through the sort of trauma of losing my son, mm-hmm. which was certainly that, but. But by just being inundated by this right. sort of river of sorrow and yeah. meaning and stuff that comes through the Red Hand Files, it's mm-hmm. just this extraordinary thing, and it can't help but change you.
Well, you and know? You can appreciate, I'm sure, the you know that energy that it gives back to an audience to have a connection, and you know it's not. On some level, it's not real, but it's authentic, and it certainly is very meaningful. But I was thinking about it in terms of, you know, I'm 61, so I was born in 63. I started listening to music in the mid-70s, and I had a hippie uncle who gave me a bunch of 60s records, and there were like a couple of Bird songs on it. And I was like, oh, I like that sound. And then I was like, who are these guys? And this was in the late 70s. There was no way to find out.
Yeah,
and there was no information on the records. I couldn't ask anybody because nobody was a hippie anymore. And I went to the library and there was like nothing. The band members' names were misspelled depending on the album and things like that. And we live in this rich world now, right? Where you can actually, not everybody who is a known creative force does this, but it's an incredible act of generosity to people to listen to what they're talking about and engage them on their level, I think.
Yeah, I mean, look, we have all this information at our fingertips, but I think that there is social media that is very different. I think the Red Hand Files yeah. aren't social right. media. The general temperature is completely different.
Yeah.
It's funny because I do get people who are pissed off at something I might have said about something or other,
right?
And they use the sort of the language of outrage that you get on social media, and these questions just sort of reverberate. You can see them sticking out of the all this beautiful river of feeling coming through, and just these nasty little letters about whatever the thing might be. But I just can't not feel a part of something on a deep level doing this sort of thing. In a way that I don't think you do when you're on Twitter or, you know, it's just a whole different thing.
So. Is it, as you're saying, you know, the Red Hand Files, it's not unmediated. It's not everything that you believe all the time, you know, and you're taking certain letters and answering them, and you're in a role when you're doing that, but it's different. You're, career in a lot of ways, and I think about this in terms of, you know, your career, like somebody like David Bowie's or Bob Dylan's, you've gone through different kind of persona, and we're always enacting that, but this seems like one of the main arcs of your career has been to become less guarded and less kind of limited in the way that you present to an audience. Is that partly, is that artistic growth? Is it, just getting older? Is it being more mature? Is it being through, you've been through an incredible blender in terms of loss over, many years, but especially over the past decade or so?
Yeah. Look, when, what I, I discovered a lot when my son died, and you obviously you change, but what I saw that I cultivated to some degree before that was to be an outsider, to live outside the world, to have a sort of slightly jaundiced view of existence and a kind of default setting of mild contempt for everything, and live outside the world, to be alien from the world. And I think when these things happen to you, you can't help but be drawn in to the world. You suddenly realize you're not an outsider, you're an insider.
Right.
You're within the world. And I felt that it was necessary for me to, it wasn't like a conceit, it was just a need for me to contact or connect with these people on some kind of level. And I didn't want to sit and do conversations. I didn't want to do that. I just felt that I could answer people's questions in a cautious, considered, compassionate way, that it might go some way of ameliorating their various sorrows about things. And it has, and it's helped me a lot too. And, I often look at it in that I think before this happened to me, and this thing that happens to us all, I was a partially formed human being. I think that's what we are as young people. We're not fully formed, and it takes a kind of devastation to complete us as human beings. And I felt once I'd become more complete, I felt that I also became more adept at being able to have something to say for other people's sorrow.
An edition of the Red Hand Files, in an entry, I think from July, you talked about how our humanness is not given to us. It's something that we're constantly constructing and creating.
I'm talking about. Yeah.
And I guess, the challenge then is how do you live with that? Because it's hard, right? I mean, the pain is unbearable in many ways. But if you don't live in the world of tragedy and despair, then you're shrinking away and you're pulling yourself out of the world.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a decision to be made when something like this happens ultimately? I mean, you can't make these decisions when you're sort of deep in it, but ultimately and there's a sort of heroicness about this, or a sort of nobility about this, is to sort of turn inward and sort of wrap yourself around the absence of the person that you've lost, and that's your world. And this is a dark and dangerous place as far as I'm concerned. And I know people who are in that place, that it's a fucking outrage to suggest that you can be happy after something like this. And I felt that I had to make a conscious decision to turn outwards and look at the world. Mm. And what I saw was myself reflected in the world. I saw my own brokenness reflected in everybody, in a way. It was a cosmic experience. It was a religious experience in the sense that of a movement from one thing to another thing. Right. And I don't mean it was a religious experience like I found Jesus or something. Right. I just found myself deeply connected to other people, and that I saw myself reflected in other people and them reflected in me. And so I was no longer an outsider at all.
Where do you think the feelings of being an outsider come from? I mean, is part of it growing up in a kind of remote place like Australia, where the center of the world, whether you wanted it to be or not, is London or something like that, or British culture?
I think we affect these things, right, too, when we're young. It's just kind of cooler.
Right.
You know, when you're a young person, to be sort of the people that you admire and all of these sort of these weird kind of mysterious peripheral sort of characters. But we also were Australian and we did come to Britain, and we were looked at with huge sort of suspicion by everybody, in a way. We did this weird kind of music. People would write articles about, you know, this is the birthday party, that our music, we'd gotten our rhythms from the Aboriginals and stuff, you know, that we were incredibly bizarre sort of.
Right.
We were certainly seen as, and cultivated a kind of.
Was that liberating for you, though, too, that you could, I mean, if you're on the outside, then you can kind of do whatever you want.
You can do whatever you want.
Right.
Yeah. And actually, when we did go over to Australia, over to London, it was sort of dead. Whatever was going on in the punk days, it sort of essentially died. And there was just a whole lot of, in our view, pretty horrible music, a kind of shoegazing, sort of self-absorbed.
What is boring. That what you disliked about it? That it was just self-indulgent or solipsistic?
It was boring. You know, we were kids growing up in Melbourne, getting the New Musical Express, and sitting there like and looking at the back pages and seeing of all the gigs we could go to. If only we were in London. Imagine what our lives would be like. You know, and eventually, after some years, we managed to get flights and go to England. Yeah. But when we got there, it had happened.
Yeah. Do you feel like it's always like that, though? You're always coming to the party late. So then, you decide like, oh, I'm gonna host the party. I'm gonna make the party.
It was a little bit like that. I mean, we did see. So there was that, but there were certain bands in London that were huge. You know, like there was the pop group. Do you know the pop group?
I don't.
Yeah, just this amazing kind of mad funk dub sort of incredible band. And there was The Fall.
Yeah.
You know, so these were sort of outsider bands too. And we got on really well with them. But there was a big sort of sludge in the middle that we had nothing to do with. But there were also bands like The Cramps that came over and played in London. And we saw them. And that was...
Yeah.
So there were these sort of... things, saving things that we could
What
kind
did
of
you
hold
like
on to.
About the Cramps?
I went to a Cramps gig and I'd really never seen anything like it. I mean, Lux walked onto stage. He just hurled the microphone at the audience and sort of dived in before anyone had, you know, played a chord on their guitars or whatever. And it was just mayhem. It was just mayhem. And it was deeply exciting, you know, to watch. And
how much, you know, there's the, obviously the Cramps have a kind of gothic sensibility, but a comic gothic on some level. What is the attraction of that? You are one of the great goths of the world, and it seems like the world has caught up. I always was amazed for a while. I lived in a small town in Ohio, and I was amazed in Walmart, everything is gothic. Everything is crosses and skulls, and it's like everybody is gothic now. What is the appeal of
I'm not sure I ever felt that that's what I was. You know, the last thing I ever wanted to be called was gothic, to be honest. Now I actually have an affection for the goths because they just never went away.
Yeah.
You know, and I often think that when the apocalypse happens, there'll be the sort of cockroaches and the goths still sort of
inhabiting the world. You've always been interested in themes about darkness, about criminality, about sin, about death.
Yeah.
And playing with despair. And that doesn't need to be a negative thing, right? Or a pessimist, you know, it doesn't mean that you don't do anything. That can actually be a spur to action, it seems.
Yeah, I think I was a narrative storyteller. I was deeply influenced by American folk music of the idea of the murder ballad.
Right.
From an academic point of view, I love to write songs where there was a visceral, violent line that would just leap out at you. All of this sort of stuff really excited me, that kind of the language of violence. To use what I liked about those murder ballads, the American murder ballads, is that they had these deeply detailed, you know, I drug her by the hair and all of this sort of stuff, these deeply detailed, violent lines that just sat really uncomfortably within a few, you know, the chords of a song. So I was trying to do that sort of stuff. I still do that to some degree. But on the one hand, you know, without sort of dismissing all of that sort of stuff, that was an affectation in the sense that I really didn't, I really didn't know what I was talking about to some degree. It was when my son died that I understood about what darkness.
So you had been kind of play acting.
Well, I mean,
the darkness.
I think play acting's maybe a bit disparaging.
Okay.
You know, I mean, I think there was a true danger to what the birthday party was doing and so forth. But I don't think I had any real understanding of the sort of precarious nature of what it was to be a human being.
Mm-hmm.
And so I could sort of play with these ideas a lot more. And because I didn't feel much for humanity in general. And that changed, you know.
Was it changing before the death of your son?
Well, you know, when I look at it, I have a kind of story that plays out that I was this nasty guy, and then a terrible thing happened, and I turned into a kind of a kind and compassionate individual.
Right.
I don't actually think that that's necessarily true. I think I always, you know, I sort of felt something about our sort of general condition of what it was to be a human being. I just was inarticulate about those sort of matters.
Why do you think you find it ready to or comfortable to tell that story of that you once were like this and then something
it's
happens?
Just, I'm a storyteller.
Yeah.
It's neater. You know, it's needed to speak that way. You know, my dear friend who died recently, Anita Lane, we were talking about this, of holding the world in contempt, and she said, that's not true about you, for one thing. She said, you always loved your mother, she said, you know. And it's funny, recently someone unearthed this big wooden trunk of stuff that my mother had kept, and in it there's like scores of letters that I wrote to my mother of three or four pages long of me when I'm living in the most dire circumstances in London, drugged out of my mind. Right. But I'm still sitting there writing these like schoolboy letters to my mother. So you know, there was, it's not like I was hated the world in that way. I don't know.
Yeah.
Before we continue with the recent interview, I want to tell you about today's sponsor, Bank on Yourself, a retirement plan alternative. Most of us have been told that the only way to have enough money to retire is to put your life savings into a 401k or IRA and then bank on Wall Street. But if that were true, why do studies show the average American who follows that advice will outlive their savings by a staggering 10 years? It's time to get the truth and discover a better way to grow and protect your money. Bank on Yourself is the proven retirement plan alternative that banks and Wall Street are desperately hoping you never hear about. It gives you guaranteed predictable growth and retirement income. With Bank on Yourself, your plan doesn't go south when the markets tumble. It gives you control of your assets. You get access to your money for any purpose with no questions asked and no government penalties or restrictions on how much money you can take or when you can take it. Bank on Yourself also gives you peace of mind because you'll know the minimum guaranteed value of your retirement savings on the day you plan to tap into them and at every point along the way. Learn the secret to safely and predictably grow your wealth every single year, enjoy tax-free retirement income, and gain control of your money. Just go to bankonyourself.com/word and they'll send you a free report about the retirement plan alternative that lets you bypass banks and Wall Street and take back control of your financial future. That's bankonyourself.com/word for your free report. bankonyourself.com/WORD. And now back to the recent interview.
Well, let's talk about the new record. Wild God, and the title track, you know, it immediately calls to mind what is arguably your most famous lyric, which where you in a previous song where you talk about you don't believe in an interventionist God, and then in the title track Wild God, which has been released, you talk about how we are all as gods. Is there a linkage there, and what are you hoping for? You know, it's stupid to say what are you hoping for with this record, but what is the sensibility or the vibe that you're putting out into the world?
Well, when I listened to this record back, which was some months ago after it had been mastered, I did so with my usual sort of reticence and kind of waiting to hear nothing but a whole lot of mistakes and as you do when you listen back to your music. And I just sat there with a big smile on my face because it felt like I was listening to a bunch of people, and myself included, that were just in a kind of good place, and that it's a joyful record, in my estimation of it, joy being in its way a form of suffering, you could say, or at least joy being something that understands, joy is an emotion that understands the nature of the world. Mm-hmm. I would say it's something that leaps out of our kind of common suffering to something greater, and it feels like that is this record in and of itself, and also the songs within it just keep doing this sort of frog-like leap.
Which, of course, God. Is one of the other great tracks on the record, Frogs, which at the Red Hand Files, you know, somebody writes in to say, you know, I really just don't understand what the fuck this song is about. And then you say, like, well, you should come up with your own interpretation, but here's mine. And you talk about that. And it does seem that suffering is a prelude to possible transcendence, that we are constantly moving up.
It's a necessary prelude.
Right. Do you feel that, this is the best art, and, you know, in a lot of ways, I think, you know, rock music or pop music does it better than any other form, where there's a personal thing going on in the creator of the song or of the music, but then also the world. And when I say we, is the world ready to get back to looking upwards or for progress after things like COVID and a number of unfolding problems now? I mean,
Well, it's a good question. I wonder if we can ever really shake what seems to become. It seems to be sort of bred into the bone, bred into the blood of the world, is a deep dissatisfaction, contempt for the world itself and for ourselves as human beings. I find that this is a sort of prevailing message of pretty much everything all the time.
Do you think it's getting worse over the past decade or so?
I feel that there is a sort of subterranean movement towards more spiritual matters. Mm-hmm. I've noticed I can have conversations about religion, mm-hmm. even like Christianity and stuff mm-hmm. like this, at a dinner table
right.
that I couldn't have had 10 years ago without mm-hmm. just being laughed out of the room. So I see that as a sort of move in a positive direction personally. Mm-hmm. But I think there is a prevailing attitude in the world of cynicism for what it is to be a human being, that we can only do ill to the world, and a kind of lack of finding any sort of value in things. And, you know, I know I sound like some old man kind of moaning on about things, but it feels
But what's interesting is you're saying, I mean, you're actually optimistic or forward-looking, whereas the typical old man shouting at clouds is that, oh, things were so much better in London in the early 80s or something like that. You're actually not saying that.
I'm not. I think it's a kind of indulgence that we can't, afford to entertain in the way that we do. Mm. Personally, controversially, I see the world as sort of systemically beautiful. And that it is broken and it's faulty and it's unjust, but at the same time, it has immense value, and that we need to look to that rather than sort of leaning back into our sort of cynicism and outrage. You know, that we need to do better than that.
Mm. You know. You've talked in recent years at the Red Hand Files about how things like Antifa, you know, and ultra political correctness or wokeness, or, you know, there's a kind of nihilism there. And you stand athwart that. I mean, that's the act of artistic creation, right? That you can make something, you can see something beautiful in the world and make something beautiful. What do you think is driving a kind of broad-based cultural pessimism? It seems particularly in the West, places like England, certainly many places in the United States, where people, if they look forward, they can only see things getting worse. They only see chaos. They only see environmental degradation and things like that.
I'm not sure what's driving it. I think that social media has a lot to do with it. I think the media in general has a lot to do with it. I'm not sure how to answer that question, but I do feel from my own point of view that from where I feel I have, I would say, a kind of conservative temperament. Mm-hmm. Not that I'm politically conservative, but that I just have a fundamental understanding of the nature of loss. And that's what worries me most of all, in a way, is that it is so much easier to tear stuff down and very difficult to build it back. And so there's a sort of a soulful feeling towards the world that I think that we've lost. And part of that, to me personally, is at one of the things that's attached to for me is the sort of secular, or that we're losing the sort of avenues of meaning. Mm-hmm. And that it's very difficult. If we don't love something, or if we don't feel any meaning in things, then why wouldn't we hold the world, look at the world cynically? And I think these avenues of meaning are being shut down.
Like what's an example of
religion?
Yeah,
is one, for example. My relation with religion is it's a structural institution where I can find meaning in things. I go to church, and I have a place where I can take my assorted sorrows. Mm-hmm. This is what it's actually for, and that it wraps its arms around that and allows me to find meaning in that. Mm-hmm. For example, now this has largely been chopped away, and we this is seen as mostly, or there's terrible variants on that that are just, America's terrible in regard to its sort of religious temperament.
What do you mean?
Well, just the kind of the sort of Christian right and mm-hmm. all of this sort of stuff, and that sort of American type of Christianity is pretty hard to.
It did help give rise to the cramps, though, for sure, right?
Is that right? Yeah. Well, you know what I mean by that. I think that there are different, even things like music. If we're talking about music, the idea that music is a genuinely transformative, transporting thing is being looked at with cynicism as well. Mm-hmm. We have like AI has sort of song generating things where you only have to put in a prompt and a pretty good song pops out, right? I don't know if you've done that.
Yes.
If you've tried that.
Of course.
And it's pretty good.
Yeah.
It's the first iteration.
It's better than anything I would do. So
yeah. It's as good as anything on the radio.
Yeah.
And it's its first attempt. And in a year or 2 years' time, we're going to be able to go straight to the product. And it's going to be indistinguishable between anything I can do or Nirvana can do or anybody else can do, right? And this is, to me, an idea that the creative struggle, which I think is the essence of meaning in this world, is seen as an impediment or a kind of thing in the way to the product itself. Right. Why bother with having to sit down and kind of do soul searching and find out what sort of song you want to do or go into a studio with your friends and try and create some sort of music? Why do we need that when we have this product?
Right.
You just drop out of this thing. And what scares me most of all is, I know I'm kind of ranting now, but whatever. What scares me most of all is that we are living in a society that is so demoralized that actually we don't really care. You know, there's a lot of people that say, yeah, but we value true human art and performance and all that sort of stuff. But I don't know. I think we can quite easily get to a place where no one cares one way or the other. Mm-hmm. And so we're just losing these avenues for legitimate transcendent experience.
And you find that religion or church, essentially.
I find that personally.
That kind of gives you a space to kind of think about that and confront that and to process.
You're talking about church for me.
Yeah.
Yeah, I find I find for myself, I don't necessarily think that this is right for everybody, and right. nor is every church as good right. as every other church.
Yeah,
that's for sure, right? But I think if you can find a place that sort of somehow creates a meaningful experience, mm-hmm. which I actually have in London.
And is that going back to where you raised, what, Anglican or whatever,
yeah,
the Australian
variant? I'm an Anglican. So
it's kind of, it's something that has always been in your life. You've talked in the past yeah. about you would go to church and then you might go get heroin afterwards, but church was always on the kind of calendar, right?
Yeah, I mean, off and on, but yeah. for sure. Yeah, I was always trying, I was always giving it a go.
Yeah,
And not exceeding, and finding most of the time I was just in church and hugely embarrassed mm-hmm. about the whole thing.
Yeah,
I don't feel that way anymore. Although, once again, that really depends on the church you're going to.
How much of not being embarrassed is because you're older and you don't care what other people think as much?
There is that, and. You know, I mean, the church I go to is, the music is so beautiful. Mm-hmm. The organist is so insanely good that it's very difficult to hold your shit together, you know, when this yeah. music starts going on. And you see everyone's just yeah. deeply, deeply moved by the whole thing. The church I go to, which I'm not going to tell you what it is because I want to be able to go there on my own.
Right.
They call it the church for atheists.
Yeah.
Because it's just on every level, extraordinarily right. beautiful experience.
So, and you're not necessarily talking, you know, theologically here. It
well,
is like
I,
a time.
I mean,
and
I have
place,
my feelings there too.
What sure. is that then? Is it? I mean, you seem. I'm thinking of you know. I mean, this shows through in your work, but also in interviews. You've talked a lot over the years about how Johnny Cash and Bob Dylan have been very important. They Cash was very much of a Christian,
yeah,
and of the sort that you were kind of I'm not too sure about, right? A kind of Southern Baptist. Dylan obviously went through a phase where he was on fire for evangelical yeah. Christianity. Leonard Cohen, another huge, you know, yeah. Kind of influence on you, spiritual if not Christian. What is your religion?
For me, the problem with all of those people to yeah. some degree, and why I feel quite separate from them.
Yeah.
Not Leonard Cohen, I mm-hmm. would say. He has a much more ambiguous mm-hmm. Relationship with religion, I would have thought. Not knowing him, but yeah. what I get from his stuff is that these people, you know, these Bob Dylan at that time had mm-hmm. arrived somewhere.
Yeah.
And certainly Johnny Cash, there's no sort of uncertainty right. about it. And I feel that I feel that I exist in a place that's somehow sort of in between belief and mm-hmm. and skepticism, shall mm-hmm. we say. This sort of very full. It's a place full of potential where the imagination is quite free to roam around. It's not locked into sort of certainty about right. things. It's not atheistic in its mm-hmm. its thing. You know, I mean, ultimately, I feel like I'm a believer amongst unbelievers and a kind of unbeliever amongst believers.
Right.
That's how it tends to feel because there's a sort of lovely push and pull
yeah.
in that area. So I'm sort of embedded within the religious right. experience, but not like a paid up.
That definitely album. Comes through in Wild God. I mean, the whole album, it seems yeah. like that. It's, I mean, literally, it's not literally, figuratively, it seems like the songs are trying to achieve escape velocity from the planet, and you kind of push up and then come back down to yeah. Earth and things like that.
It's the leap of the frog.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, with its little hands.
Yeah.
Fingers extended.
You know, do you feel, I mean, to be a bit more optimistic about things, you're, in a way, you have never been more popular, more present as a figure on, I would say, on a kind of like musical stage or on a world
yeah.
stage. It seems like that, the yearning that you're articulating is widespread and kind of acknowledged by people.
I think it's like I said before, you know, I think people are less embarrassed about talking about these sort of feelings of these yeah. particular needs, spiritual needs or religious needs, in fact. I've just noticed that. you know, I've had people say, hey, can I come along with you to church?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, and I'm like, yeah, sure, if you want.
where does your belief, one of the things that really strikes me as increasingly unique about you, and this depresses me because more artists aren't like this, you absolutely defend the right to free expression and to thought. You know, this is a regular feature in the Red Hand Files, but where you say you're not going to apologize for past songs where there are lyrics which are now no longer, you know, politically correct or whatever you want to say, or that are offensive. But you're also not glorying in that. But you talk a lot about the attempts to shut down kind of free speech and free expression, even or especially in the artistic fields, is insane. Where does that belief come from, and why do you think that seems to be less kind of front and center among creative people these days?
Yeah, I mean, this is changing. This is a conversation that feels kind of retro to some degree. Mm-hmm. You know, I think people just got sick of it, and I think people in the end don't like art that's like that. They want art to be challenging and interesting and confronting and offensive, you know, and outrageous and these sorts of things. I think people just basically, most people want that, you know. And I think this idea that there's a generation who I don't really buy that in a way. And you know, I also don't really buy, I mean, I know the idea that you can't say things and stuff like that, I think feels kind of kitsch or something like that, you know, when people say that sort of stuff, in the sense that, you know, what you're doing, what the whole podcast world, the whole online world is just full of people having like these so-called dangerous conversations, right? So in that respect, free speech is alive and well. But I think in regard to music, the tide has moved out. It was just a sort of dumb period. And the people in the end don't like bad art.
Right.
You know, they like art that challenges you and
so
you know,
somebody
sort of troubles
like,
the water a little bit.
Right. So like Kanye West, whose latest record is filled with various kinds of anti-Semitic and misogynist tropes, if it's good music, people are still going to listen to it.
Yeah, unfortunately, I would say I think that it doesn't really matter if people are anti-Semitic. Actually,
right.
I think that's not one of the things that people are particularly worried about,
yeah,
I would say, unfortunately. And I don't, it's not the part of Kanye that I, you know, I don't go to his records because they're anti-Semitic.
Right.
But I go to Kanye's records, some of Kanye's records, because he's doing some of the most interesting music I've ever heard. And his gospel music, I don't know what the impulse behind
you must
that
love
is.
That, right?
It's extraordinary. Yeah. I mean, I've never heard gospel music like that. I listen to quite a lot of gospel music.
Yeah.
I've never heard anything like that in my life. It's pure brilliance as far as I'm concerned. Deeply catchy and musically extraordinarily beautiful stuff. So, you know, Kanye is like many great artists, a sort of broken, fucked up individual. But I'm not worried by, I'm always encouraged by humans that can create beautiful things yet be these broken individuals. Like, it's the distance traveled between what they are capable of creating, the awesome nature of their art, and the sort of fucked up nature of their personalities. This sort of journey is something to be celebrated.
Yeah.
You know, it's not, we don't get rid of the beautiful stuff in order to punish, we don't get rid of the best of us in order to punish the worst of us, if that makes any sense.
Totally.
Doesn't make sense at all to me. I have a particular problem with anti-Semitism.
Yeah.
I don't like it.
What does that stem from?
I
realize that's a ridiculous question to be asking. What is wrong with? Why are you so anti-Semitic? But why is anti-Semitism a particular issue?
I think it's a little bit like we were talking about before, when you were talking about it, the Anglican mm-hmm. religion. It's from my childhood. Mm-hmm. This has always been my religion.
Yeah.
So I've not been interested in other religions. It's mm-hmm. just been the one I'm happy with. And I think as a child, I was raised in Melbourne. I was just grew up in Jewish areas. Mm-hmm. I was surrounded by Jewish people. Yeah. I knew many, many Jewish people. My first girlfriend for 3 years was a Jewish girl. Mm. You know, I just have a relationship with Jewish people. Right. That, you know, so it's kind of a personal thing. And it's weird because there's also the sort of biblical element. I was really fascinated by the Bible as mm-hmm. a young person, you know, and when I left Australia, it wasn't to get to England and it wasn't even to get to America. I wanted to get to Israel because this is where all this stuff happened.
Right. Yeah.
You know, like this is, I could stand on the Sea of Galilee and I could go to where Christ was supposedly crucified and, you know, this was extraordinarily exciting for me. And this is, you know, regardless of all the horrific complications mm-hmm. that are going on in Israel at the moment, deep down, I have a sort of a abiding love for that place, you know. And so, and you know, let alone the history of the Jewish people, of course.
I
just want to alert you now. I've done like 6 radio interviews in a row.
Right.
So if I'm sounding a little bit sort of hysterical and sort of rambling, it might be.
I was going to say, you know, you have over the years and at various points, you've pushed back against people. And, you know, I'm thinking Roger Waters, Brian Eno, who have tried to shame you for performing in Israel. You know, where does that kind of mentality come from? And these are people of incredible talent and who pushed, you know, they enlarged what was possible in popular music or in music as well as creative expression. And to, you know, what does it feel like when people like that are saying, no, you should not be doing that because that artist that, you know, should not be allowed. As an artist, you should not be going to Israel.
How does it feel for me? Well, I mean, there's obviously larger issues, you know, and it's not about me. Mm. I just feel, you know, and I'm no friend of the government of Israel, but I just feel on some level that I find it difficult to come to terms with using my music in order to punish ordinary people because of the acts of their government. Mm. You know, it sort of comes down to that to some degree. Where it comes from for people like, you know, these are different people.
Right.
Brian Eno is a different kettle of fish to Roger Waters. You know, Roger Waters, I think, is deeply damaging to the sort of boycott movement. Mm-hmm. It's embarrassing. Yeah. Brian Eno is a different character. He's just a thoughtful individual.
Were you a big Pink Floyd fan at any point?
Yeah, when I was growing up. Yeah, I mean, their early stuff for sure.
What does it feel like to, you know, both be acknowledged by one of your musical heroes, but then to be disparaged by them? That's a kind of interesting two-step.
I wasn't that much of a fan. Well, you know, I mean, I was a big fan of British progressive music. I loved all that stuff, you know. So,
what did you like about that? Is it that it's...
Well, it was my brother. I had an older brother who listened to all that sort of stuff. So I grew up on loving the music that he did. And then I found the Stooges and MC5 and so forth. And that sort of music took a back step. But I really go back to that music these days, like King Crimson and stuff like that. But, the thing is, we don't really get much shit about that sort of thing these days. I mean, I think the BDS essentially works on the fact that if you're going to play Israel and they come down hard and you don't, it's a win. If you do play Israel, they basically leave you alone because it's...
Are there any countries that you wouldn't play?
What? Historically?
Oh, I don't know.
I don't know. I'd have to say.
I guess if you got an offer to play in the Cavern Club in 1942, that's a different story then.
Yeah. You know, I mean, obviously. So I don't know. I'd have to sort of think about that. I can't, nothing's sort of jumping at me.
Right.
You know, I don't personally, I know, look, I understand that this is a controversial thing to say, and I just don't agree with a cultural boycott in general. I mean, there are places where it's worked, I think, mostly because it doesn't even work.
Yeah.
I mean, clearly it's not working,
right?
You know, in Israel at the moment. I think, in my view, it sort of emboldens the very worst aspects of the current government. They exploit the sort of isolationist thing, like the whole world is against us.
Right.
You know, no one will come and play, which just, I don't know. I think it's used to further their nefarious agendas, and at the same time punishing ordinary fans. But that's sort of, I think, how I feel. I mean, it's awful what is going on over there, and you know, but I just don't feel comfortable with. That I know after this, the Red Hand File inbox is going to be, you know, a swamp of abuse and stuff like that. But anyway,
what do you think?
It's actually why I don't really speak about this sort of stuff.
Yeah,
is because I'm trying to protect the Red Hand Files, and the Red Hand Files is a very, very beautiful thing.
Yeah.
But it's vulnerable, and it's vulnerable to. Kind of abuse.
Do you obviously started in Australia, you moved to London, and then after the death of your son, you lived in Los Angeles for a while, right?
Yeah.
But you didn't much care for Los Angeles.
No, I loved Los Angeles.
What did you like about it?
I went there, you know, I have a bunch of friends there, and we had this thing going, really. It's about 10 of us, really interesting people, and we would sort of meet every weekend, sit around a table, eat, and sort of talk about stuff. It was really quite a beautiful time. And all these sort of, you know, it was really rich, creative place. And it was sort of sunny all the time and kind of distracting from the sort of woes me and Susie were carrying around with each other, it was a beautiful experience. But then sort of COVID happened and we went back to Brighton. you know.
Did you, your mother died during COVID and
yeah.
you were not able to
no.
attend to her?
No.
How did that make you feel about kind of the way COVID was handled?
I don't know. I couldn't fly to Australia. Mm. And I think even if I did, it was difficult to go to into the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
So I watched my mother die by Zoom, you know, and by my sisters. My sister was allowed in by iPad, and then by her iPad, and then there was a funeral, which my son Earl Grimley called a Zoomeral, because only six people were allowed into the church, and everyone else had to sit out in the car park. And I could watch on what was happening on the screen. So on some level, it was deeply, deeply distressing. But at the same time, I didn't at that point. For me, the jury was still out on whether the lockdowns were a good thing or a bad thing. And I don't really have anything to say about that one way or the other. Mostly because my own personal experience of COVID was so positive, in the sense that I had a year off.
Yeah,
I could spend it with my wife. My son Earl came to live with us. It was a sort of richly creative time. Mm. It was a very strange thing, because I was living in Brighton, facing the sea, and it was the sort of summer and the spring, and I was sitting on the balcony. Behind me was the hospital that was piling up with, you know, corpses.
Right.
You know, so it was a really weird, troubling sort of, but creative times.
Yeah.
Anyway, I don't have much to say about COVID one way or the other. Really.
Do you see that? You know, so I mean, it's horrible to be away from a loved one when they're dying, but on another level, to be able to kind of be present is an odd moment in humanity, right?
What, because of
technology or whatever?
Yeah. I'm not sure. The final memory I have of my mother is a sort of glitching sort of picture on a small screen. Yeah. You know, and I'm not sure whether there's much advantage in that. And I really only found out how I felt about that whole thing when I finally got to go to Australia. And, you know, it was quite emotional to do that.
Yeah. As a final question, I guess, right now England is going through, you know, a particularly violent moment. There are riots in London, I guess, and other places. The government is talking about shutting down certain types of social media or certain types of speech. You know, does that kind of action worry you? And if so, how does it?
Yeah, I mean, it does worry me. Although I think these platforms are toxic as anyway, I'm not. I don't have much love for these platforms. So, you know, they shut down Twitter altogether, I'm not going to lose a lot of sleep over it. But as a sort of free speech issue, I think people should be allowed. You know, I basically think more speech is better than less speech. But I find social media, for other reasons, enormously problematic.
And is that because it flattens and falsifies interactions with people, or?
Yeah, it completely destroys the idea of nuance and any conversation whatsoever. From a personal level, I used to go on Twitter, and I. just sort of follow it. I never participated. I was just sort of, you know, I don't think I could see one person that I loved, you know, and admired, not be, you know, completely diminished by the form itself, you know.
I said I had one last question, but this is the actual final question, which is you are you're in an industry where people are not known for aging well, you know, and you are almost three times past the 27 club and things like that. What is your secret? Because this is also where, you know, I think you've tapped into, or you're kind of vibrating like different things that are going on, over your career. But one of them is like you seem to be aging backwards. You're both your creativity, your physical appearance and things like that.
Yeah, is the 20 years of drug addiction and good face cream.
Okay. Yeah. So it's basically laying off the drugs helps.
I won't really go into that, but I think you're talking about other things, right? Are you just talking about the physical?
No, I'm not just talking about the physical. I mean, I guess it ties back into your relationship of you opening yourself up. Is that part of the de-aging process?
I think there's a whole raft of things that I'm interested in doing that just keep me alive and keep me engaged in the world in different sorts of ways. And I feel old and sort of bold, I would say, in the sense that I feel the world has taken its best shot and that I'm not kind of worried about how I'm perceived in the same way as I may have been worried, say, 10 years ago, or more careful about the way. So this frees you up to all sorts of things. So I feel very free in the world. And it's funny, I've talked to a lot of people have said this to me, but that have lost people in the same way, is that it just doesn't matter. Things just don't matter in the same way. What can really happen to you that is of any true, you know, I don't know. I just feel sort of creative and sort of bold to do whatever I want to do. And I think old age tends to sort of shut you down. Mm. It can shut you down. Each project is kind of exciting. So I'm looking forward in a weird way to make another record. Mm-hmm. I have some ideas about that. And these things are invigorating. Mm. Does that sound right?
That sounds very good to me. Nick Cave, thanks for talking to Reason.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks, Nick.